To all who believe in the power of dreams, welcome. Disney's California Adventure opens its golden gates to you. Here we pay tribute to the dreamers of the past, the native peoples, explorers, immigrants, aviators, entrepreneurs, and entertainers who built the Golden State. And we salute a new generation of dreamers who are creating the wonders of tomorrow. From the silver screen to the computer screen, from the fertile farmlands to the far reaches of space, Disney's California Adventure celebrates the richness and the diversity of California. Its land, its people, its spirit, and above all, the dreams that it continues to inspire.
Hi, I'm Johnny V.
Hi, I'm Daniel.
And I'm Jonathan, and welcome to the Laughing Place Podcast.
On this episode, we're going to be celebrating Disney's California Adventure's 5th birthday. We're going to be discussing possibilities for the Pomona Lot, the biggest expansion space for the park in Armchair Imagineering, count down our top 10 favorite details of the park,
and more. So let's get started with Rachel with the news.
The Hollywood Foreign Press Association has announced the 2007 Golden Globe Awards will add a Best Animated Feature Film category to the award ceremony. In honor of the film's upcoming anniversary, a special CD release, Lady and the Tramp and Friends, will arrive in stores February 7th. The CD includes tracks such as Bella Notte, Home Sweet Home, Something There, and Kiss the Girl.
It may just be me, but I'm not sure exactly what Kiss the Girl and Something There has anything to do with Lady and the Tramp. How could they be friends? Lady and the Tramp live in the city and Ariel lives underwater.
Well, maybe the CD had the dog singing.
Disney is currently working on a movie screen adaptation of Prince Caspian, the next volume in the Chronicles of Narnia for 2007. The principal cast from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe are expected to return.
I'm not exactly sure how Disney's going to translate this book into a movie because I read it not too long ago and I felt that it's a much harder, it'd be much harder to make a theatrical adaptation than The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It just seems like a much less cinematic book.
Didn't the BBC try to take Prince Caspian in the next book and smash it into one movie? I wouldn't be surprised if Disney tried to do that with some of their 7 books.
It seems to me that they're going to want to try to milk as much out of this franchise as possible by making all 7 films, and next thing you know, they're going to have an Aslan CD or something.
The Aslan and Friends in Calypso.
The Oriental Land Company announced a Monsters Incorporated attraction is heading to Tokyo Disneyland's Tomorrowland. They also announced Cinderella Castle Mystery Tour will close April 5th. The U.S. Disney theme park's Pirates of the Caribbean attraction will close in March to receive new audio animatronics based on characters from the hit film.
I'm not sure if I understand why they're exactly changing Disneyland's version of Pirates, because every time I've been in there, it always is busy, and as far as I know, they've never had trouble reaching their capacity. I mean, as long as there's people inside the park, it seems like they always reach capacity on the ride, so it's not like they're cycling a lot of empty boats, so it seems to be almost to be a waste of money to put in the effects. Florida is a different story to me. I've heard a lot of people come off of the Florida version complaining that there's no Johnny Depp, and a lot of people don't even realize the ride was built before the movie, because it doesn't have the same classic status in Disneyland. I mean, people grew up in Disneyland. People grew up in California knowing that, you know, Pirates was there. It was a part of their childhood. They grew up, and then they watched the movie in reflection of the ride. It wasn't the other way around.
Well, from what I hear from Imagineering, that it's not really going to change the ride so much, because they're just putting Johnny Depp in a few of the show scenes, and, you know, Barbossa but it's not really going to affect the ride. You're still going to be able to see the guy squirting water in the well and, you know, the bio winch section, you know. So it's not really going to change that much. It's just, oh, now the 12-year-old girls have another reason to go to Disney World.
It just seems that it's almost... I almost would prefer them to keep the differentiation between the versions as much as possible just to encourage people to visit both resorts.
So you would rather have, like, a movie version at Disney World and then the classic version at Disneyland?
I'd even go with the next step and just say, out with the old and in with the new entirely. I mean, if you want to do something like that, if you want to tie it in with a movie, you might as well do it all the way.
Hopefully, even if they don't change a lot of the show effects in Florida, they will go up and upgrade the animatronics like they have in California, because it just saddens me when I see the auctioneer doing about an eighth of the movement as the one in California.
Sources have indicated that Tarzan Rocks is to be replaced by a Finding Nemo show at Disney's Animal Kingdom Theater in the Wild. The team behind Broadway's Avenue Q have helped conceive the show with Disney Creative Entertainment.
I think it's a good idea. I would love to see some sort of bold statement with, you know, fish puppets inside of that theater as opposed to guys rollerblading.
I think it's a very good idea because it essentially fills the void which Animal Kingdom has. Animal Kingdom doesn't have a very long indoor experience, like a dark ride type attraction. I mean, it has Dinosaur, which is thrilling, and then it has the Festival of the Lion King, which is a show. But this, I'm assuming they're going to go more like the Voyage of the Little Mermaid route with a lot of blacklit puppetry. And if they do that, then it's essentially like giving an audience a 20-minute dark ride. And I think that would be a great idea. I think that's a great idea for Animal Kingdom. I think that's exactly what it needs.
It'd be interesting to see the technological advances in that sort of puppetry, because, I mean, the Voyage of the Little Mermaid, as nifty as it is, I mean, you could, it would be interesting to see if that sort of method has been improved. I mean, I could just picture in my head, like, my jaw dropping, because they could do some just really, you know, crazy stuff with that sort of...
Well, it's also a spectacle, and Animal Kingdom doesn't have anything like a spectacle. Festival of the Lion King is very interesting in its staging, but it is very also a... but also the major point of it is the singing and the live performers, whereas this is going to be more, I think it's going to be more pure spectacle, because I don't see how they could incorporate too much music into it, considering the movie doesn't have very much. I'm assuming that it'll have like a score, but I don't think people are going to come out and sing songs with puppets in the background.
They could put in Randy Newman. You've got a friend in the sea. You've got a friend in the sea. When the currents go up ahead and you're miles and miles from the coral bed, just remember what Marlin said. Or maybe not.
And now it's time for Armchair Imagineering, where we formulate ideas for Disney theme parks around the world. Today's topic is the Timon lot located behind Disney's California Adventure, which is the biggest expansion space for the park, connecting through the farm and Bugs Land area and Flix Fun Fair and the Pacific Wharf. Let's start off from a comment we got from the message boards from Indigo. He says that his vote is for a continuation of Pixar Land. NASCAR and Cars would tie well together, and he'd love to see what Disney could do with that next. Which I also think is a very good idea. Cars probably is going to be a huge movie. I don't see why not. It looks good. Pixar has a good track record, and I think that the theming of the movie would seem well to the California concept in terms of not standing out too much, because from the previews, it seems like it is in California. I think the original title of the movie was Route 66 anyway, so I'm assuming that it's going to look like California in the background anyway.
Speaking of a track record, what type of ride system would you use?
Wow, that was a bad segue.
Yeah, I try.
Well, I think that they could use the test track system. I mean, it's been a little bit rocky in Florida, but
that doesn't have a good track record.
No, it doesn't, but I think that hopefully they've worked out the kinks, and they have run it at Journey to Center of the Earth in DisneySea without major problems, so it's a good ride system.
I thought the Journey to Center of the Earth ride was more of a rocket rod system, wasn't that? Or was that the test track system too?
It's all, as far as I know, they're all fairly related. Test track is the most advanced because of the starts and stops, and it has the video screens and whatnot. But as far as I know, they're all similar to each other. Rocket Rods, I think, was the lowest in terms of what the vehicles had to calculate. But I think Journey to the Center of the Earth is probably in between them. But of course, there's always Johnny's old idea of incredible Spider-Man attraction. Woohoo!
Yay! I think that's a good idea. I think that, especially since there isn't a ride system like that on the West Coast, that would fit in with the park. It's edgy, and, you know, you wouldn't necessarily have to use Incredibles, but that would be very cool, especially since you can't get an Elastigirl audio animatronic. Is there room enough on the parking lot to put both of those ideas into place?
I think that the Timon lot is big enough. I don't know exactly what a footprint of those attractions would entail, but I believe that you could fit a good 2 e-tickets, if not maybe a little more, in that spot. I remember it being huge. It's pretty big. If you do something like Spider-Man, I don't think you're going to have that much space for the other attraction. But you could also try to, if you work it, you can fit a lot. I mean, you see Fantasyland in California has all these rides that go on top of each other and whatnot, and to some extent, I was surprised DCA didn't do that more, considering the lack of space, but I think they could start doing that now in the Timon lot and trying to incorporate rides on top of each other or in and out of each other,
yeah,
or whatever they have to do.
Yeah, that's the one thing, because if you did a Spider-Man type ride, the building would not exactly be big, it'd just be in the way of everything, really. I mean, it's not like it would take up too much space.
Or you could do a Tokyo Disney Sea thing, and one half of it's Mesa Mountain, the other half is, Industrial Skyline.
You could all, yeah, it could definitely go behind Tower of Terror, I think, and you could theme one side of the building essentially as a flat that looks Hollywood, and then the other flat that would be seen from the other side would look seen the Incredibles or whatever. You just have to build the facade. If you put it on the corner of the property, then two of the walls that face the streets don't have to be themed at all, because you're not going to see them from within the park. So it's very doable.
If they did that, it would be the park with like the most big icons ever. You'd have the big mountain with the big city in the back. They'd have the big tower. They'd have the big coaster. They'd have the big grizzly and the big sun. They'd have a whole lot of big stuff.
And they would have space for 2 giant billboards facing Catella and Harbor Boulevard.
Oh, wait, I forgot the Monsters, Inc. facade, which is, like, huge. There's a lot about that. Everything's bigger in California.
Not everything's bigger in Texas.
But, well, they have the stars at night. They're big and bright. Deep in the heart of Texas.
Wow. I think I just saw a shark, and I think we just jumped over it.
I do it like 7 times every episode.
Well, I think this is a safe... I think I better cut off this conversation before we get too much more off topic. So this has been Armchair Imagineering. Next week, we're going to do a sports-themed episode to kind of theme to the Olympics. And so we're going to be discussing ESPN involvement in the theme parks. ESPN is a very valuable asset that Disney currently owns and hasn't done much involvement in the theme park. So, if you have ideas for how they can involve ESPN more in the theme park, and I'm going to repeat that 1 million more times, please call us at 1-866-327-5072. And if you're under 18 years of age, please make sure you have your parents' or guardian's permission before calling. February 8th marks the 5th anniversary of Disney's California Adventure, so now let's take everyone back to the beginning. I was there on January 7th, I believe that was the day I'm on the secretary, January 7th, which was the first cast member preview day of Disney's California Adventure. It was pretty cool. I saw Michael Eisner and Paul Presser walking around. I wrote Thorin, saw Steps in Time, the first version before they added the Fairy Godmother, which opened a few months later, which I thought was a really good show. I liked Steps in Time a lot at first. The second version was the Fairy Godmother, not so much, but the first version was really nice. And then they had the annual Passholder days, which were crazy. That place was insanely busy. It had 4-hour lines for Sorn, and 3.5-hour lines for Grizzly River Run, and 90 minutes for Screamin', and I think it was like 60 minutes for the Orange Stinger. It was scary. I remember. Of course, the biggest change over the first year at DCA was the entertainment. We had some strange acts, like, remember Three Bags Full? Okay, Three Bags Full were essentially people that came out in what looked like pillowcases. However, they were very shiny, and they were different colors. I think it was like purple, gold, and a blue. And they could hold it really close to their face where you could see their face through the fabric, but only the outline of their face. So they could push their face through. It was actually rather creepy, and I'm not exactly sure what it had to do with anything. And then after a few months, they started going through all the DC entertainment and adding characters everywhere. Because you had the Mini Earhart Show, and Mickey's Garden, and Max joins Lafitte, and the Cruella story.
Donald Vision.
Donald Vision. Those were interesting.
I liked the Mini Earhart Show because I worked at the popcorn cart right next to that plane where they did the show, and I thought that was very entertaining. It was for me, especially since no one ever bought popcorn there.
The only thing about those some of those shows that was very strange was the characters didn't talk because they didn't record any dialogue, so the characters had to just mime, which
later,
I found a little peculiar.
Later they did
add dialogue to Mickey's Garden, which, did you ever see Mickey's Garden?
I saw part of it once, I think.
Weed the people of the United States in order to farm a more perfect onion.
No, I missed that part.
And then there was Cruella's story with her wacky assistant. I don't remember his name. It was like Norman or something that did the robot and did the sprinkler for no apparent reason. And of course, one of my favorite aspects of DC Entertainment, Eureka, which is very underrated in my opinion.
You know, I love that show. Anytime you get to see a fortune cookie being chased by a big box of Chinese food by a giant pair of chopsticks, I'm in for that. I love that show.
It was a great parade, and I think it used the performance corridor rather well. But seriously, one of the coolest things about the parade was that it used the sound system they have in DCA, which is really good because from section to section, the blocks along the parade route, the music would change, but the way that they did the music in Eureka was that it would segue really well from section to section. So you had like the Latino section going into like the urban section, so you went from the Mexican sounding music to the rap music. But the way it would blend was really cool because basically once the float got to you, or once the first dancers got to you, the music would just abruptly change. But the song was the same, it was just the arrangement that was different. So it was almost like the parade was performing just for you because the sound was so in tune with what you're looking at. I mean, it was much better than like the Magic Kingdom where you start hearing parade music 20 minutes before it gets to you. But in general, Eureka was just a very elaborate parade. The costuming and the puppets and live drumming. And I really think the only reason it wasn't that successful was that it didn't have Disney characters in it, because I can't think of any other reason why it wouldn't have been. It was certainly well done.
Those yellow costumes were sure elaborate. She catch my drift.
I remember when the first year of California Adventure, one of the problems they had is they didn't have enough shade in the park, so they were handing out free tiny bottles of water. That was a fun few weeks in the summertime.
I remember that. It was one of their biggest deals, like even in their recap that they did for the cast members, it was like, 30 new shade areas. And you're like, yeah, all right, why didn't we think of this before? Then we had the revolving door of Hyperion Theater shows. First we had the original Steps in Time, then the second Steps in Time with the Fairy Godmother, then the Power of Blast, and then finally Aladdin.
I liked it. I know a lot of people didn't like it because they said it wasn't Broadway enough, and some people said it was too Broadway, but I thought it struck the right chord for that area of the time at California Adventure.
Remember Divine? That was cool.
Divine was awesome. Divine was cool. Divine freaked me out the first time I saw her.
In case you don't know, Divine was, I guess, an actress, you might say, who dressed up. She was painted all green, wore an all-green outfit, and then was on stilts that were covered in vines and ivy to be. Basically, the only thing you could really see was her face, and she could obstruct that by moving her arm in the way and basically stand up against the fence or just stand in the walkway and look like a huge shrub and then come to life as you pass by and pretty much scare the living daylights out of you. And then they had the orchid and the wandering wisteria. We've also seen a lot of specialty events, like remember Cal Ripken Day, the Cal Adventure,
Anaheim Angels Day.
Anaheim Angels, A-OK. Anaheim Angels all the way. I never heard that song before, and I'm not even sure where that song came from. I guess every team has a song.
I think that was just their song.
It's an unwritten rule that every sports team has a song that they pull out for these events. I'd really like to hear the Tampa Bay Devil Rays theme song.
But now they're the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, so that would make the song a whole lot longer.
Los Angeles Anaheim, A-OK.
And then, of course, Rockin' the Bay.
Woo!
Great entertainment and no shade.
It's a knick-knack, Patty Black. Give the frog alone.
And that song. I think I heard that joke about 25 times, at least. Today's top 10 list is about the top 10 details in California Adventure. So, we start off at number 10, the water fountains themed as showers in Paradise Pier. I think it's really clever because basically they look just like the showers they have at the beach. Number 9, the Frankie and Annette posters at Pizza Ooh Mau Mau. And I love the fact that they collected posters and paid tribute to that aspect of California history, which I think is somewhat notable. Number 8, the Hidden Walt Disney at Manhattan Beach.
I think this is a really cool detail that they had in there. You see hidden Mickeys all over Disneyland. Why not have a hidden Walt over at California Adventure? Plus, he's blowing fire out of his mouth.
Number 7, the It's a Small World Bee sound within the Orange Stinger.
I think this is a cute little effect because they have all the bee sounds, but then if you listen very carefully as you're exiting right after the ride stops, you can hear one of the bees buzzing the It's a Small World song. Cute touch.
Number 6, the layered music in Paradise Pier.
Well, I like the layered sounds of the background music at Paradise Pier. Once you walk by Orange Stinger, you hear bees playing along with I Love L.A., but if you walk next to, let's say, Jumpin' Jellyfish, you get bubble sounds that go along with the sounds of Surfin' USA or whatever. I thought that was a very cool touch how, you know, you get a personalized background music for each attraction in Paradise Pier.
Number 5, the Path Behind Grizzly River Run.
Well, I just love it when theme parks manage to put in an area where you can walk where most people aren't going to walk. You kind of have to go out of your way. So it makes it a more tranquil area to walk through if it gets busy. And also, it makes it more park-like.
Number 4, the Beast Room in the Sorcerer's Workshop.
Lots of great details here. The rose that's projected inside the glass that slowly the petals fall. And then the whole room changes and does this transformation. It's really a very cool room, I think.
The fire was cool. I like the fire. The fireplace. Number 3 is the souvenirs from former tourists at Grizzly River Run.
That's one of my favorite little bits in that ride is when you're about to reach the unloading platform and there's a big chair set up there that says a souvenir from... No, it says like souvenirs, you know, cheap, light water damage. It's very humorous to me.
Number 2, the fact that the It's Tough to Be a Bug queue looks like Ant Island
from A Bug's Life. This is one of my favorite details because it's something that doesn't really hit you at first. You're walking through it and you're like, this looks somewhat familiar. And then it occurs to you that they have recreated the opening shot of A Bug's Life. And I think it's really cool.
Now, number 1,
It is. The wave fountain at the entrance of the park, right under the sun. This fountain is so cool, I could practically watch it all day. Back and forth. It's really neat how they made the effect of the wave. I've never seen another fountain like that, because it basically travels from one side, a wall of water, to the other side, and then the full waterfall. Very impressive effect. Definitely captures that perfect wave feel they were going for. Well, that wraps up another fun-filled episode of the Laughing Place podcast. Next week, we're going to be doing a sports-themed episode in honor of the Olympics coming up. So if you have any sports-related comments involving Disney, or if you have any ideas for ESPN involvement at the theme parks, you can call us toll-free at 1-866-327-5072. If you're under 18 years of age, please make sure you have your parents' or guardian's permission before calling. Yes. You can also email us at podcast@laughingplace.com, or just post in the podcast section of the Laughing Place discussion board. And now, Jonathan, with the last word. April showers, spring, bandage. Goodbye.
Bye.
See you.